Chief of Naval Operations with representative officers and enlisted personnel from local commands at 10:15 Friday, 16 October, 1970.
Do I come through now? Do you hear me now? How's this? Do I come through in the rear now? Does anybody in the rear hear me?
No, Admiral.
Can you hear me in the rear?
Yes.
How's this, gentlemen? Can you hear me in the rear?
Yes, sir.
I'm here today to speak for just 10 or 12 minutes and then to answer your questions so that I can learn from hearing your questions your primary concerns, and we can use both your time and mine to best advantage. What I want to say in my opening remarks is that in the last 5 years we have seen the Soviet Union achieve strategic nuclear parity with the United States, and we have a nuclear standoff. And in that same time frame, we have seen the Soviet Union construct a powerful surface navy, which is getting closer and closer to having a capability to match ours. At the same time, in the years ahead, as a result of the domestic aspirations of our people, who desire to see the elimination of crime, corruption, poverty, and pollution, objectives we all support, and who are disenchanted with the war effort in Vietnam, we see a prospect of declining military budgets. And for the next 2 or 3 years, until the pendulum swings, as it always does, we are going to find fairly thin pickings with regard to naval budgets. I have made the decision that there are priorities that are necessary within these lesser budgets. I intend to err in favor of the future at the cost of the present. This means that in order to be able to continue to procure new ships, I will give up some of our older ships. It means that we will be increasing the percentage of our budget that we spend on research and development and on nuclear propulsion in order to have many more options coming out of the research field to deal with the Soviet threat, and in order to have a hard core of nuclear ships to rapidly redeploy to any threatened part of the world. It means that we are going to have to give priority to electronics warfare, command and control, surveillance systems, and reconnaissance systems, those kinds of things which will give us the capability with lesser forces to try to do what we did to the Japanese in the Battle of Midway by having broken their codes, namely defeat them, a larger force, with our smaller forces. I further have concluded that it is going to be mandatory in the years ahead, and beginning this year, to sacrifice things in favor of people. And I have stated that I will give up shore activities and ships in order to be able to get the money to devote to those priority programs which provide benefit to our personnel, whether it be in the form of CPAY, which we have now gotten through the Department of Defense, but not yet through the Bureau of the Budget or the Congress, or whether it be increasing the support available to our medical facilities, or whether it has to do with increasing the number of detailers available for officers and enlisted personnel in order that you can get more personalized treatment, or whether it has to do with self-help projects for transient motels and increased numbers of military housing units. These sacrifices, these reductions in our strength, are in a larger sense not reductions in strength if, as the result of our efforts, we improve our retention rates. Because without the skills which you have to bring, if we are constantly having to retrain larger and larger numbers because of our losses, our Navy gets less and less efficient. And if we turn around the retention rates, our efficiency improves, and it was well worth the sacrifice. Whether or not the sacrifice was worth it, in my judgment, the time has come when it is necessary to start making these sacrifices. I have the view that for too long, our country, all of our taxpayers, have expected sacrifices from their military men above and beyond the call of duty in peacetime. In wartime, these sacrifices are to be expected from all of our citizenry. But in peacetime, in order for us to do the jobs well, the jobs which will always remain tough and challenging, it is mandatory that we work hard to improve the individual welfare of all those military personnel who are manning our systems. Now, with that much background, I would like to pause and ask you to fire away your questions so we can concentrate more directly in those areas of interest to you. In the front row. Are you still able to hear in the far rear?
Admiral, I'm concerned about the fact that in our Navy, we do not at present have a school or a training course to train naval officers for the type of warfare that we are going to have to face, perhaps, and that's the multi-threat one, where AAW and ASW and electronic warfare have all got to be combined. I've examined the schools that we have at present, and I don't see this anywhere where especially the lieutenant and lieutenant commander can learn how to fight his ship in the war that we may be asked to fight.
Were you all able to hear the question? The answer is that the question is a good one. We have much work to do in order to be able to say that we are accomplishing the objective you've just defined. One of the things that we're going to be trying very hard to do, and this takes time, is to develop the kind of multi-threat training facility that really makes it possible for us to get the training in port for two reasons. One, as you know, it's becoming more and more difficult with the forces we have available to put together the kind of a multi-threat at sea that's necessary for us. And in the second place, it's becoming, even when you do so, it's very difficult for people to rotate through and get a lot of training during any given fleet exercise. And therefore, a training facility which does present this opportunity to throw the threat at you in a series of sequences that lets people rotate around does, in my opinion, give us the best long-range hope. With regard to the schooling aspect of it, I request that you write out your thoughts and address them to me personally by name And I will get my staff to take a look at your ideas and to see what more we might do to head in the direction you've suggested. Over on the far side.
Senior Chief Postmate O'Brien, Admiral from the Underwater Demolition SEAL Training Division, FHIP School, NAB. Our people have to compete with the fleet in advancement for rating. Now, why couldn't there be a specialist rate, such as Specialist S or Specialist U, which was in effect during World War II, that would permit our people to actually be tested on what their mission is, reconnaissance, parachuting, submarines, diving, and I think this would make an all-around better underwater demolition team operator and a SEAL operator than having to compete such as a cook. Now, a cook can go to a Class A school, and the most cooking he ever does is a can of sea rations over a can of Sterno for himself. And he actually competes with people in the fleet for a particular rate, and it's not really to the advantage of the people in the fleet nor to our individual to have to compete this way, because we have a special code, I think, which gives us a little bit of advantage. And if a rate were given or put out that would permit our people to take a test, you know, on what they actually, our mission actually is, I think it would benefit the Navy and the fleet as well.
Let me say that as a result of my 2 years in Vietnam, I have the utmost respect for the tremendous job the SEALs and the UDT sailors are doing. Man for man, I think they contributed as much to the war effort, perhaps more than any other group. They're a tremendous, gung-ho, courageous, adventure-loving, patriotic outfit. As a result of what I saw from their performance, when I came back to this job, I initiated a study to see what could be done to enhance the core nature of this group. It is in the process of being staffed, and this specific question is one that I will throw into it. I tend to favor direction you suggested. In the white.
Good morning, Admiral.
Good morning.
One thing I would like to suggest would be something that wouldn't cost any money, a little more uniformity in the Navy. I think that this is I don't know what's being done about it, but I think this is a great problem where one man in at one base gets treated in some way and in another base a different way due to the personal likes and dislikes of certain people in the command position. And if we do this, it won't cost any money to for a regulation to be followed, like, for example, a uniform regulation. I believe that a commanding officer should have the decision whether or not we put a wall in here or whether or not we move troops, but to tell a man whether or not that he doesn't like personally a mustache or sideburns or wear dungarees on my base because I don't like people to see people in dungarees, I think this wouldn't cost anything, and it would improve the morale greatly throughout the whole Navy.
We have a number of directives that have been issued seeking uniformity in various practices, and another one which will be out, I hope, within the week, which will specify some additional uniformities that will, I think, solve most of the concerns you suggested.
Thank you, sir.
In blue in the front.
I
Morning, Admiral.
Morning.
In regard, I'm out at NAS Miramar, and most of us out there in regards to the F-4 aircraft, which is one of our best fighting planes in the fleet today. And my question dealt with proficiency pay. I happen to be a metalsmith, and your mechs and many more of us, we do not get the proficiency pay because we're not in your, well, most of your electricians and AQs and people of this nature do get it. I was wondering, is there any chance that the metalsmith may ever get proficiency pay again or do away with it altogether and just raise everybody's pay? Because one man's job is as good as the next.
This question of proficiency pay, I have found, is one of the most controversial in the Navy as I go around. Some are very strongly for it, and some are very strongly against it. And surprisingly, even some of those who are getting it don't think it's a good idea. The rules concerning the payment of it, rate by rate, believe it or not, are specified outside the Navy by the Office of the Secretary of Defense. We used to be able to pay proficiency pay in all ratings, and that was taken away from us by the Office of the Secretary of Defense on the basis that it had to go to those ratings where we were quite short and not to those ratings where we were less short. My view is that each rating ought to qualify for some, and we're working to try to get that policy changed. I can't promise that it will be changed. To the larger question, there is a great deal of consensus in Washington that the time has come to give everybody a full and proper day's pay for a full and proper day's work. And the effort to achieve an all-volunteer force is recognized by all levels as one that can only be done if we make significant increases in pay scales. I think when that happens, we may find that only such things as CPAY and the variable reenlistment bonus remain, and that other kinds of special pays, and even the additional pay that a married man gets, are washed out, and that everybody gets a pay increase at a constant level by pay grade.
Thank you, sir.
Over on the far side.
Admiral, my name is Chief Guerrero, DC-3, and my question concerns the dungarees being worn from the job to home. I noticed a lot of Navy bases have allowed this practice, and it appears that it has enhanced morale. And I'm wondering whether this new directive that will be issued in a week will concern itself with that.
That is one of the items that is proposed for the new directive, and there's a great deal of opposition to it and a great deal of support for it. It's another one of those issues upon which people feel very strongly. I'd like to ask for a show of hands as to how many here feel that the right to wear dungarees to and from work would enhance morale. Let me ask for a showing of hands on the part of those who don't. Well, you see that even here we have some difference of view, although it's not very evenly divided. Now let me ask how many of you feel that it would be reasonable to insist on a very high standard of cleanliness of dungarees if they were authorized? And how many do not? Thank you very much. This will be helpful. In the front row.
Admiral Chief Warrant Officer Seidner, USS Sperry. My question was prepared by warrant officers and LDOs in Sperry. It's directed toward the time required for a warrant or LDO to serve in each grade before he can be promoted. Admiral, by virtue of their selection, these officers are superior performers, yet they're required to wait in what we think is an inordinate amount of time for promotion, with no program for selection, early selection, of warrant officers. An already well-trained ensign LDO is required now by the new directive to wait 15 months for promotion to Lieutenant JG. A W01, already well-versed in Navy life, waits 2 years for Chief Warrant Officer 2 an additional 4 years for CWO-3 and four more for CWO-4. A warrant could be selected from W-2 to LDO ensign and make lieutenant as soon as he could make CWO-3. Also, many warrant officers serve in department head billets or lieutenant billets, yet are monetarily compensated at a lesser rate than some of the CPOs serving as their division leading chief petty officers. Is any consideration being given to a more equitable program of pay and promotion for warrant officers?
I think that's the first time I've ever gotten a question along those lines, and I'm not familiar with any effort that is being made. If you will turn that question over to Commander Davies over here on the far side, we'll take it back and have it staffed to find out what the pluses and minuses are. Over on the far side.
Yes, sir. I'm Data Systems Technician, Third Class Hudson from USS Kitty Hawk. My question concerns proficiency pay that I am receiving at this time. I spent approximately 22 months in Navy schools before my first duty station, which was at Kitty Hawk. At that time, I was sent immediately to the Mess Deck Master at Arms Force for a period of in excess of 3 months. As far as I know, as regulations concerning proficiency pay, I'm allowed to work out of my rate for 90 days before I lose it. I worked on Mess Deck for approximately 100 days, therefore I was subject to loss of pro pay. Now, my relief happened to be the second class data systems technician. He was joined on the Mess Decks by another third class data systems technician, and also on the ship's Master at Arms Force, there had been a second class data systems technician. These are just the DSs that I know of, but I know that there are several other critical rates such as AQs, ATs, RDs that are receiving proficiency pay, working on jobs such as these out of their rate. Now, I am grateful to receive the extra money, but I cannot see that these men that spend so much time training, and in my case, approximately $40,000 was spent on my naval education. Now, this seems to me quite a waste of time and money for the Navy.
Let me say with regard to this that having been a skipper of three ships, I know that, and then having commanded large numbers of them, I know that there are always problems with the administration of an unpopular duty, such as the one through which you're going, and it is necessary to have some rotation and flow. Therefore, I think it would be unfair for me to comment as to the specifics of your particular situation. But I do agree that it is very important for us to get the benefit of the very expensive training we have put into highly qualified technicians such as you on the job for which they were trained. And I would hope that any system set up on individual ships would take that into consideration in working the system out. That's a pretty fuzzed up answer, but I hate to get too far into the ship's business. Yes, Chief.
Admiral, I'm concerned about retention and of the senior petty officers. It seems that VRB is set up to keep people in for approximately 10 years, and then what is the Navy going to do for the people after that? Also, in carrying out your Z-grams, sometimes the senior petty officers is really let down, and being relieved or standing watch is it normally was stood by a fireman or a third class. I think it's good to answer back if we can implement your Z-grams, but I think it'd be good to ask how we did it.
Yes. Let me say with regard to the question of implementation that we have recently established the Office of Assistant Chief of Naval Personnel and Assistant Chief of Naval Operations for People. This is a Rear Admiral, David Bagley, who is just in the process of setting up shop. His job is to implement, to look at the implementation of the Z-grams and of all other directives that impact on people. He'll be with his people visiting various shore and sea activities, as will I and many others, to find out the status of implementation. It'll be some time, maybe a quarter, before they have sufficient people to really do this job in detail. Let me go on to say that that we have another very good check and balance in this system, and that is that Chief Black gets many letters, as do I and others, and it's possible for us right from Washington to tell which ships are really with the program and which are not. As a specific example, let me tell you that I have an overwhelming body of evidence that comes in through a number of sources to Washington that the Ticonderoga has done a particularly good job in this regard. Now, with regard to your first question that has to do with the question of looking out for the people after 10 years, let me say that I share very strongly the view that we don't want to forget that group. We are supporting legislation to authorize an increase in the, or to permit a variable reenlistment bonus for a second reenlistment, which I consider to be highly justified. And we are insisting through a directive, which I don't believe is yet out, but will be, that for the reenlistee beyond his first term, he be given, within a range of reasonable choices, his choice of shore duty or sea duty, if he prefers. I agree that we must not lose sight of the fact that there is a second 10 years to that career, not just the first 10. One of the ways in which I hope to develop additional ideas as to what we can do to help in that regard is through the new CPO advisory board that isn't yet functioning but will be shortly. Can we take some in the far rear there? I've got a couple of hands up in the far rear on each side.
Admirals, I'm Walt, Master Chief Quartermaster Hoffman, representing Fleet Training Center San Diego. We advertise in our recruiting posters the free legal assistance is available to members of the Naval Service. We are careful, however, to say that not complete legal assistance is available. We would like to know if there are any plans being originated or considered that will place either Judge Advocate General Corps officers or civilian attorney employees in a position to represent naval personnel before civilian courts in all manner of civil actions.
This is not a program currently under consideration. There again, I'll ask my staff to take that back with me to Washington and we'll take a look at it. I suspect that we're going to find that that's one which is so costly that we may find that there are other personnel programs that ought to be supported first. However, there are certain things that occur to me that can be done. One is more full use of those Navy lawyers in areas where they're not fully employed. And another one is the identification of lawyers who have come in as enlisted personnel. We do have some in the Navy, and it may be possible to work them in a few places. On the other side.
Good morning, Admiral. My name is Thomas Irvin, First Class Burris, and I'd like to ask you a personal question. First off, did you get a personal letter from Commissary and First Class Burris?
I'm not sure that I did. Can you describe what it had to say?
Yes, sir, Admiral, I can describe what it had to say. It was about the death of my wife, which left me with four minor children, and I am presently stationed on a ship, and I would like to know that I spent 18 years in the Navy, and why can't I be put ashore so I can be able to look after my minor children, because right now my wife is permanently dead and I only have gotten temporarily help. And every time that my ship is put to sea, something always come up and I have to be flown back to San Diego, which is more money out of my pocket. And when I joined this Navy 18 years ago, I was told this is a can-do Navy, and why can't somebody do something about my problem?
I did not receive that letter. How long ago was it written?
Approximately 3 to 4 weeks.
All right. If you'll give your name and ship to my staff up here in the front row, I will see to it that you're put ashore. I cannot understand why a widower with young children has not been immediately given that opportunity.
Thank you very much, Admiral.
Sutphin, Naval Station, San Diego. Morning, Admiral. I would like to ask if any consideration is being given to us administrators, the tool of a different type discharge to get rid of some of these rinky-dinks we're supporting around here. And the other thing, has any consideration be given to a reevaluation of the recruiting practices in the Navy today? We're receiving too many people that are costing me, you, and the rest of this Navy a lot of money.
Let me assure you that we're giving a lot of consideration to both of those problems. I personally asked recently that we examine what could be done to process more rapidly the rinky-dinks. One of the problems that we have is that the whole system of justice in this country, which after all is dedicated to protection of the rights of the individual, require that this process not be one of undue haste, lest an individual's rights be harmed. What we're looking for are ways to safeguard these rights while nevertheless getting the job done. For example, it may be possible to let a ship immediately get them ashore and then take time to do the job right there with adequate personnel. Let's see, your second question had to do with recruiting practices. I gather you're referring to the recruiting of less than top quality people. We are doing our very best to insist that discernment on the part of commanding officers be practiced, and that we do not want to achieve high reenlistment rates by recruiting the non-performers. A non-performer or a poor performer costs us more than he gives us. We want only the man who does his day's work to be reenlisted, and I think you'll see in the months and years ahead that we are moving in that direction. Now, with regard to the recruiting at the outset, this is a tougher problem because, first, there are certain limits on us as to the screening process through which we can go, And second, it's much more difficult to perceive at the outset whether a man is going to be a good performer or not. But we're working hard to improve that through increasing the number of recruiters so that each one can take a little more time with the individual case.
Good morning, Admiral. DC-1 Yarborough Firefighting School, Fleet Training Center. We at Firefighting School and some of the instructors around the Firefighting School have discussed the problem to quite an extent, and that is proficiency pay again, if I may. What we'd like to find out, all qualified instructors which has gone through IT school and are now qualified instructors in a Navy bona fide school, why we don't receive pro pay. If there is some discussion on this matter at the present time, we would like to know about it. Because we feel that we are top-notch instructors. Maybe some of us are up above the average sailor because we teach them. So we'd like to find out why we don't have pro pay.
The problem there goes back to that I discussed earlier, namely that the specification as to what ratings may be eligible comes from the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and further, there is a limitation on the specific amount of money that can be paid within a given rating. If you come from a rating for which pro pay is authorized, it's a problem that can be solved within the Navy by just examining the priorities. And if you come from a rating in which pro pay is not authorized, we have to date not been able to get that policy changed by the Office of the Secretary of Defense. With regard to the first issue, this is a priority which I will raise when I return to Washington. I wouldn't want to make a commitment as to the outcome, not knowing what the competition is for a limited amount of funds. I think the real long-term answer is for us to continue to try hard to work on making all ratings eligible and to get more pro pay until that time comes when we get the significant increased pay of the all-volunteer force. Yes, standing up.
Good morning, Admiral.
Morning.
My name is Bucklew, ADJ-2. I represent Underwater Demolition Team 12 and Underwater Demolition Team 11, Underwater Demolition Team 13, SEAL Team 1, SEAL Team 2, and also Bud's Training.
You got a lot of votes.
Admiral, not too long ago, we've had a few initiatives brought forward for our unit in retention and also the morale of our troops. And one of them was a device stipulating our unit, and they brought forth quite a few of them. We haven't seen them, but all of a sudden we received two, one showing a SEAL team device and one showing a UDT device. Now I've got two examples here that I'd like to have you look at, Admiral. There is not one person, and I repeat, not one person in UDT, nor SEAL team, nor BUDS, that would like to wear this Army device. It was devised by an Army lieutenant, and we don't have anything to do with the Army, Admiral. And I know I've been in UDT for 5 years. I spent a year and a half in SEAL team. And, Admiral, I don't want to wear this thing.
Have you got some samples of the devices that you did submit?
No, sir. We work very hard over there in our UDT, as you well know, and our SEAL teams, and we don't have enough time to really sit down and draw these things. Right at this moment, Admiral, I'm wearing standard Navy jump wings on my left breast, and this device shows exactly what I am. I'm a Navy parachutist. We are one of the only people besides parachutists with the aviation in parachute rigging that wear this device.
Let me say that we'll take the device back. We'll show it to the retention group working on problems of SEALs and UDTs, crank it into the hopper, see if we can't find someone who can be spared to come in and give us a view as to what would be an acceptable non-Army device.
Thank you, Admiral.
Over on this side.
Good morning, Admiral. My name is Mott. I'm a senior chief electrician mate.
Morning.
I'm coming off the USS Parsons. At this time, I'd like to discuss with you one of your Z-grams, specifically number 44. It states here that, on the second page, paragraph B, use of officers as quarterdeck watches, watch standards, shall be limited to those very occasional periods when safety, security, tempo of activity or protocol required. Well, Admiral, we'd like to believe on the in the ship there that safety, security, tempo of activity or protocol is never on an occasional basis. What I'm getting at, sir, is it seems like it's demeaning the job of officer of the deck here just to have the ensign standard or petty officers, senior petty officers.
Let me say that this is a sentiment that I have ascertained exists in other places. It may be that I goofed on this one. One of the problems that I discover it's causing is that petty officers who would be available to help piece out a 1 in 6 by watch standing in the engine room or elsewhere now have to be pulled up and put on the deck, and this therefore is hurting another one of the Z-grams, that one which says get to a 1 in 6. My objective in issuing the one you've just read was to continue this process of delegating down responsibility and authority as far as we can. I have the feeling that our petty officers have not been used as responsibly as they can. I have the feeling that we can push responsibilities down all the way from the top and make the job of the supervisor more challenging because he deals with less specifics, and make the job of a man who has been on a Mickey Mouse kind of thing more important. Now, I am going to redefine that Z number 44 to make it clear that if there's a conflict between that and the 1 in 6, that the 1 in 6 takes priority, because that is a far more important objective. We will take a look at the whole, at the wording of the thing. There certainly is no intention to be demeaning, but rather to increase the pride and respect of being a petty officer by giving him a responsible job. And to be very frank, if I didn't have a staff, there wouldn't be any caveats like that in these things. But my staff works hard to protect me from myself, so that the in cases of true emergency, you can kick up the level of responsibility, which is the way it always ought to work. After all, when things get emergency enough, it's the skipper himself who takes the con. Gentlemen, we're unfortunately at the end of the time that's been allotted for this. I wish we could go on with your questions because they've been most helpful. I'd like to say just a word or two in conclusion, and that is that we can sit here all day and talk about the directives from Washington and try to improve your understanding of them, but all they really are is a representation of a spirit and an effort on my part to try to revitalize and refocus upon the importance of the individual. Now, nothing that I direct is going to work unless each level within the Navy helps me to make it work. What I need from each of you in your respective jobs is to ask yourselves the question each morning or each evening, how have I helped to improve the lot of my subordinates? How have I helped my superior to do his job easier? Have I made the suggestion to my boss that will eliminate an inefficiency? Have I explained to him why Seaman John Doe has been goofing off, that he's got a wife who's in trouble? Have I done my part in that area of my responsibility to help take the load off of my guys so that they can get their job done better and with more fun and with more of a feeling of challenge? Now that's what this is all about. All we can do from Washington is wag a little bit of the tail of the dog. The real question as to whether or not that dog gets up and walks depends on whether each of you here really get behind this. I know there's a tremendous amount of inclination to do so. Let's all, each in our respective places, continue to really give it hell, and a year from now we'll be a long way down the road. God bless y'all.